Okay, the Joint Interim Committee on Natural Resources will come back to order. We will round up members. We have a motion on the floor for LC Draft 1037 to be introduced as a committee bill. And I'm going to call for the vote. The clerk will call the roll. Those of the opinion that it should be introduced as a committee bill will vote aye, and those opposed, no.
Do we have a quorum? We do? For Senator Shields.
Well, we have Senator Byer and Senator Mosley, so yes, we have a quorum.
Look in the hall. And
No, even.
Senator Byer?
Aye.
Senator Duke?
Oh, not there.
Senator Mesley?
Aye.
Senator Shields? Senator Sampson?
Aye.
Senator Keane?
Here.
Senator Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Crowe?
Aye.
Representative March? Representative Von Anderson? Representative Tomei?
No.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Co-Chair Ferrioli?
Aye.
Co-Chair Crowe?
Both aye.
Representative King votes no.
And Representative King will be noted as a no vote. We have the motion carries. And that we'll introduce it as a committee bill. Thank you for your indulgence with the technology. Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, I move LC Draft 1037-1 be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Smith has moved LC Draft 1037-1 to be introduced as a committee bill. This is the same bill as a referral to the voters. Is there discussion?
Madam Chair?
Yes. Who is it?
Byer.
Senator Byer.
This is not a constitutional referral. They are both legislative bills. LC 1037 could easily be amended to add the referral added to it.
Okay, so you're saying we don't need the dash one?
They have the exact same relating clause, with the exception of the referral clause. I'm all vote for it, but I don't understand the need for it to amend a referral into any bill.
Would there be a time constraint? I mean, if we do it now, would it speed up the process more?
I don't think so, because I don't anticipate 1037 going through without amendment anyway.
Okay. What do you think?
Yeah, I think she should withdraw.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I'll withdraw LC Draft 1037-1.
Okay, Representative Smith withdraws her motion for LC Draft 1037-1 based on Senator Byer's very valuable wisdom. Thank you. So we're out of work session, and that's all of our drafts. Thank you, committee, for your indulgence.
Okay, we're going to drop off now then.
Oh, yeah.
Had a good meeting, the rest of it.
Thank you for joining us.
Have fun wherever you are.
Aloha.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. More suntan oil on for me.
Okay, we're going back to informational meeting, and I would like to have ODF&W come back up, Ed Bowles and John Platt. And is John still with us?
No,
he is not. Sorry. We apologize.
Madam Chair, my name is Ed Bowles, Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Mr. Platt had to leave for another engagement, so he will not be able to speak with you, but conveyed his support and pleasure for the tribes on the moving of the legislative concept forward.
Can you, will you be filling in on what he had to say?
Madam Chair, I probably won't try to speak for the tribes other than just anecdotally if you have questions. And I can give some examples, if you'd like, of some innovative tribal recovery efforts going on, particularly in northeastern Oregon. which is some of the things he was going to speak to.
I'd just like to put on the record that we do very much appreciate the work of the tribes. We know they have contributed greatly to this process, and we regret that he had to leave.
Madam Chair, before lunch, we were most of the way through a presentation of how this definition of recovery and the results of the workshop play out on the ground. Would you like me to continue that with your consideration of time? I can just move into questions if you'd like. It's up to you.
We're right at 3 o'clock. We have an hour. If we could take 10 minutes for a presentation and questions, that would be good. We have two more presentations.
I will then just briefly wrap up mine and then go to questions. Senator Shields had brought up the issue of how do we know that what we're doing with respect to recovery of Lower Columbia River Coho, the management actions actually, are they contributing, or is it just simply the perhaps the whims of ocean conditions and others? And so I've got a couple slides that hint at answering that question. But as we were talking, we were looking at Lower Columbia River Coho as an example of this recovery definition in action. And as I mentioned, just from an abundance or numbers of fish standpoint, we do see from this slide that we have now gotten back up into the delisting criteria side of it. But as we also discussed, it's more than just numbers of fish. It's also their survivability. This graph, once again, gets at the survivability with populations that are above this line are in a rebuilding mode, and years that a population is below this line are in a decline mode. And so this criteria would require us to be maintaining some semblance above the line. And the question is, how much of this recent improvement in survivability was due to man-caused actions versus just nature's blessing? This represents somewhat of an answer to that. This is the fishery and how much harvest has occurred on Lower Columbia River Coho over time. And these naturally produced fish, Lower Columbia River Coho, were harvested at over 80% for decades. And that sort of a harvest rate on naturally produced fish is not sustainable. We were able to recognize this as the primary factor limiting recovery of Lower Columbia River Coho, not the only factor, but the primary factor. And we're able, through our management with our management partners, Washington, as well as the federal government in the fisheries out in the ocean, able to reduce this down from excessive rates down into much more manageable rates of nearly 20% or less.
Madam Chair?
Representative Prep?
Just a quick question, Ed. It is a little shocking to see that high of a harvest rate, but going back to what you just said, there's a time period there from 1959, when I was born, clear up into almost the early 90s there, where those ranges appeared, the harvest rates stayed up there. How the species survived, the runs survived. When you say that kind of harvest rate isn't sustainable, and it looks pretty ugly, I have to admit, but yet they kept doing it all those years. Why did they keep doing that all those years?
Madam Chair and Representative Krupp, although the harvest rate was sustained at that level, the naturally produced fish were not sustaining at that level. They were slowly going down. And for part of that period, we have had basically a little over a decade of robust ocean conditions that allowed us a little bit of slack to overharvest them. What happened here was that the Lower Columbia River was managed for hatchery-produced fish and fisheries, and the fish weren't marked differentially. And so the wild fish basically got caught up in that harvest rate, which is acceptable for hatchery fish to be able to produce harvest them at an 80% or 70% rate.
Okay, thank you.
This happened to be, for the case of Lower Columbia River Coho, an example of where the primary limiting factor, landed in our own lap, so to speak, for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and our co-managers. And so we're able to take care of that as a key piece.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Chu.
If we hadn't been harvesting at between 80 and it looks like 99%, between 59 and 93 or 4 there, if we hadn't been at that high level, would we have had to drop down to that 20-30% level from 93, 94 forward? I mean, what is the naturally sustaining level? If we had only harvested at 60%, say, what would have the outcome been? Is there any way you could know? I mean, I know I'm asking a bunch of impossible to answer questions, but I'm really fascinated by how we impact our environment here.
Madam Chair and Senator Shield, it's hard to tell exactly where it would have panned out, but typically productive, naturally produced populations or wild populations can be harvested at rates 30% on up to 50% at a maximum to be sustainable. That's built into the fact that these populations are productive enough that those are surpluses to what's needed to just replace their young. And in this case, we had excessive harvest rates that was coupled with a downturn in ocean productivity, as well as some background issues related to habitat and hatchery practices that all came together in the mid-90s to push this group of fish to the brink of extinction. We were able to respond with the changes in harvest rates and have made also progress in our hatchery practices and some of the habitat issues. And that combined with a turn in ocean conditions has allowed the population to rebound quite quickly. And that is very encouraging. After recovery has been secured, I would expect us to be able to harvest fish at around 30% for this particular group. Now, I want to mention, though, that we now have the ability to differentiate our hatchery fish from a wild fish and therefore afford them even greater protections to maintain it in this low level for wild fish and still harvest our hatchery stocks at nearly 80% because they are marked and we through catch and release. This doesn't work for all of our fisheries, but they're sport fisheries, it does.
One follow-up question.
Go on.
This is a fascinating graph. Is it possible that I think Jeff would appreciate the answer too, because the harvest is 80 to 100% here. But what was the actual number? Was the actual number declining through that period, or did the actual number of the harvest remain high?
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, this just represents one of the populations in there where it shows the actual numbers of fish over time.
Yeah, not back to 54, though.
Absolutely not. And we don't have this population split out, so we can't determine that. But this just shows you an indication of numbers bouncing around quite dramatically, depending on environmental as well as fishery efforts. And this particular one, this represents escapement to the spawning grounds. And you'll see that when things, we were still getting naturally produced fish during this blip in the mid to late 80s due to very good ocean conditions and good outmigration conditions for these fish that allowed them, even with relatively high harvest rates, to still be successful. But when things were not going well for them environmentally, they crashed very quickly, and that is represented by this basic decline here. And I think we have I'm very cautious at claiming success, particularly with the ocean that has turned around, and we can't bank on above average conditions all the time in our oceans. They ebb and flow, as you well know. But in this case, because we have gotten a handle on harvest issues, I'm very confident that we are moving towards delisting for Lower Columbia River Coho. I just wanted to touch briefly on the hatchery side of things because it relates to our definition. Where in this definition of recovery, we do not exclude any of the management tools available to the fisheries managers, and that includes the use of hatcheries not only to provide fisheries but also as a conservation tool. Lower Columbia River Coho, we have a suite of options for hatchery practices here that are represented. This just shows the different types of hatchery uses and includes intensive fisheries shown in the kind of fuchsia color area associated with our hatcheries, and those don't have much concerns with hatchery stray rates. It also has the other bookend is areas where we're managing for very little hatchery influence, and then some areas in the middle that we're actually using hatcheries as a tool in an attempt to jumpstart naturally produced populations to have them contribute towards delisting. So it's not a one-size-fits-all approach to hatcheries that we're embracing in here, and it's consistent with this definition of recovery where the hatchery tool has a role as well. We also have some habitat issues that we've been addressing. Once again, some of them land in our own lap, and they're associated with barriers above some of our hatcheries in order to keep diseases and pathogens out of our hatchery water supplies. We're moving forward with ways of opening up that habitat again to naturally produce fish above these hatchery intakes and then managing the pathogens as best we can through different techniques.
Ed, can I ask a question? I'm just confused. You have the purple hatchery areas, but the whole Columbia there, you don't have the hatchery fish. And I don't understand why that is, why there's some on the coast and some way up the river, but none in between.
Madam Chair, I'll just explain the color coding a little bit. This is the colors are specific to the tributaries in this case, not the main stem Columbia itself. There will be a mix of hatching wild fish all within the main stem. These starred areas are where we have existing hatcheries that produce coho. And what we're allowing is associated with those, we are managing for hatchery fish. In other words, we will not have concerns about stray rates associated with hatchery fish spawning in the wild, anything related to that. Now, we have some areas, as I mentioned, we will be opening up above these hatcheries that we actually can use experimentally to allow these to be managed for wild fish, but they will be using hatchery fish to jumpstart some of these. And we have that same thing here. This is a section of tributaries, Klaskanine and Scapoose Creek, that actually were, for all practical purposes, extinct during that 90s, stretch in the 90s. We are not seeing naturally produced fish coming back here, even during the robust years. And so we will be using some hatchery stocks from some of these, probably from the Sandy, to actually attempt to jumpstart some of these through different techniques, whether it be some egg boxes. We're actually going to be getting some of the local members of the public involved in coming up with various types of solutions for using hatcheries as a conservation tool in a kind of experimental mode in some of these areas to see if we can jumpstart them. And then here again, we have man-caused barriers, both on the Sandy and in the Clackamas Rivers, that we can then manage above those very definitively for keeping hatchery fish out, and then allow for very high hatchery influence down below and allow those fish to spawn naturally.
Can I ask you why you don't, and you probably already said this, mm-hmm. but why the LC isn't on there and some of the other hatcheries at Fall Creek?
Madam Chair, this is specific to that the circle that was drawn for Lower Columbia River Coho. The Alsea and others are called coastal coho, and it's a different grouping of fish. Even though the same species, it's a different grouping, and in the federal context, those were listed originally as coastal coho stocks. Madam Chair, that's all I have on this presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions or explore other areas that you'd like.
Senator Shields.
I just wanted to ask him if he could also tell us what John was going to tell us since he's gone. But that may not be possible. But because I was, one of the reasons I'm here is to hear both of you.
Madam Chair, this gives me remarkable latitude, doesn't it?
Don't worry, I'll be careful.
You'll never do.
No, for this in particular, bringing us back to the context of the work that the task force was charged with, several, you know, Representative Jensen can concur that we had tribal involvement, and they were here specifically today to lend their support for the legislative concept and for the work that the workshop did, as well as the task force. And so we were here basically singing from the same sheet of music. There wasn't going to be any discontent with that, and they voted in support of the definition. Now, as you're aware, I think most of you, particularly with the SR Squared Committee, subcommittee, our agency, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, has just completed, their commission has adopted a native fish conservation policy that is new after 2 years of effort, and that included tribal involvement and tribal support for what we brought forward to our commission. And Mr. Platt, Don Sampson, and myself are very excited about test driving that policy consistent with this recovery definition in different areas that we have co-management on. And fundamentally, what that brings to bear is it moves away from one-size-fits-all sort of criteria and management standards and allows us to custom tailor not only what recovery looks like, but also custom tailor how we get to recovery based on the needs of the species in the individual watersheds and the various public groups that we have there and their desires for those recovery. And so Northeast Oregon, which is one of the areas that the tribes have really been involved with, have been pushing the envelope, so to speak, regarding the use of hatcheries as a conservation tool. The Nez Perce tribe, which Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission does have as one of its four treaty tribes, have just built a new hatchery which uses conservation principles quite rigorously. They're moving forward on supplementation of Falls Chinook, Snake River Falls Chinook. They have Umatilla River that not only the Nez Perce tribe but mainly Umatilla Reservation is very involved with, where they have taken hatchery fish and helped jumpstart that system that historically or in the recent past was very poorly fitted for salmon and steelhead. And so they've combined the hatchery tool with aggressive and innovative habitat actions, including water to be put in the river for the Umatilla. And that has paid dividends. Right now there is a lot of fish coming back and the runs are robust. By no means does that translate to recovery, though. We still have a ways to go to demonstrate that these fish can be self-sustaining on both good and bad years of ocean conditions, but some very encouraging places. My sense on this, not speaking for Mr. Platt, is that I'm very optimistic that we're entering a new era of Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and the treaty tribes in the Columbia Basin, a new era of finding much more common ground to move forward on some projects than we have in the recent past. And I'm pretty excited about that because we certainly have more in common than we do that divides us.
Thank you. Representative Krupp?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Some time ago, I took a trip out to the Fall Creek Hatchery on the LCA, and your folks there were describing how you wanted to sort of modify that hatchery to really mimic nature in terms of running water through it and having gravel beds. And so instead of spawning hatchery fish in concrete chambers, as we have done traditionally, it was more of a mimic of nature type of concept. Where are you at on that project? I'm just curious.
Madam Chair and Representative Krupp, I appreciate you bringing that up. It is something that's very important to our agency. In fact, Director Ball has championed this personally and will we are currently putting together technically exactly what a it's being called, rather than a conservation hatchery, is kind of more of a hatchery research center that's focus will be on conservation hatchery issues. And the siting of it that we have picked out is at the Fall Creek Hatchery site, which has its own ironies, and it is very well suited for this sort of approach, and it's very close to the scientific community out of Oregon State University and our Newport office with NOAA Fisheries and others there. So it's set up very well. We are currently exploring funding opportunities, and I know these are somewhat tough times to be thinking so grandiose, but is certainly a seed that has been sown right now and being very well received on all sides of the debate on hatchery and wild fish. I think I can speak to all of them being cautiously optimistic on the concept of a hatchery research center that could aggressively pursue some of the questions that have plagued the hatchery and wild fish debate for quite a long time now. We recently met, Director Ball and myself, with some of our federal co-managers, NOAA Fisheries, used to be called National Marine Fisheries Service, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and they are very excited about this concept and anxious to help us out and pursue some funding. We're looking for somewhat of a cobbled approach to the funding side of this because we recognize that no one source is probably going to be able to pull it off during these times. You will probably hear more about this as we head into the session. Obviously, it is not part of any budget package that our agency has, and therefore we are not in any way proposing this as part of our budget or asking for money associated with it from that standpoint. But I think other groups may be interested in some legislative concepts.
Thank you, Ed. And Madam Chair, I would say that I think it's apropos that they would choose the particular Fall Creek Hatchery, which, as you and I know, was ground zero for a lot of the eruption of the controversy over this issue in 99. Thank you.
Representative Krupp and I were there in the pouring down rain. Well, thank you so much, Ed. We appreciate you bearing with us and giving this excellent presentation.
Thank you, ma'am.
Committee, we're going to recess briefly. We have some cake outside. We'd like you all to take part in it. We have some presentations we'd like to do for members that are leaving us. So we will then go into the rapidly moving landslides discussion. So please stay with us. Thanks.